From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. New York Governor Eliot Spitzer resigns today as more evidence against him stacks up in a prostitution scandal.
Over the course of my public life, I have insisted, I believe correctly, that people, regardless of their position or power, take responsibility for their conduct. I can and will ask no less of myself. For this reason, I am resigning from the office of governor. At Lieutenant Governor Patterson's request, the resignation will be effective Monday, March 17, a date that he believes will permit an orderly transition.
Barack Obama also adds to his primary victories, and former vice presidential candidate Geraldine Ferraro stands by her comment that Democrat Barack Obama is only where he is because he's black. For more on those issues in this week's political news, we have Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She's an author and nationally syndicated columnist, and Robert George, associate editorial page editor for The New York Post. Hi, folks.
Hello.
Good to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, I think all of us are probably having a better day than Eliot Spitzer. And he made his first statement on Monday, admitting that he hadn't met his moral and ethical standards, being vague enough, not really saying that he'd done anything legally wrong. But why do you think, Robert, that it took him 2 days to finally step down?
That's a good question, because talk about the handwriting being on the wall. It wasn't just on the wall. It was in big red neon. Actually, it was probably on big red neon over on 8th Avenue when it was. But I mean, the fact is, I think the only reason why it took him long, it had to be because of legal considerations. I'm assuming, and we're obviously all of the New York Post reporters, as well as every other reporter in New York, is still tracking all this down. But I would assume that there were negotiations going on with the federal prosecutors in terms of is he going to be prosecuted for the various federal laws that attach to his moving money. He was moving money around to hide the fact that he was paying a high priced hooker outfit. So the question will be: did he make that deal that he would resign and would not face prosecution? And we'll obviously find out all those details in the next few days.
Donna, when you look at this case, I mean, Eliot Spitzer is someone who took on the titans of Wall Street, and he was known as a crusader. Does it undermine the work that he did on corporate governance and on financial management for him to have this kind of a massive scandal? I mean, there have been so many cases in American history and, frankly, across the world where politicians have one standard when they stand up in the state house and another standard entirely in their personal lives. Are these two, should they be conflated?
Well, yes and no. Look, I think Governor Spitzer violated his oath of office. When you swear to uphold not just the Constitution, but state laws, he clearly violated federal and as well as state law, if these allegations are correct. And now that he has stepped aside, perhaps he will have the kind of time needed to clear his name and to perhaps clear up any controversy. Eliot Spitzer ran on a platform to clean up the culture in Albany. And it's been a very difficult year for Eliot Spitzer. He's been embroiled in petty fights with the state legislature up in New York. Some of the Democratic lawmakers are not fond of his style, fond of his style of governing. So this gives now Lieutenant Governor, Acting Governor Dave Patterson, an opportunity to really change the culture in Albany, but more importantly than change the culture in Albany, to really bring about the kind of change that Eliot Spitzer ran on, but even expand upon that, because I think New York, like other big states in the Northeast, is suffering from economic problems, a downturn. And while Mr. Spitzer did some great work as a prosecutor, there's still much more work to be done. And now Dave Patterson will have to shoulder those responsibilities.
Well, Donna, let me just ask one thing of Donna before I go back to you, Robert. Spitzer was a superdelegate and apparently committed to Senator Clinton. What do we know about Patterson's support for either candidate?
Patterson was also a superdelegate. He's a member of the Democratic National Committee. He's my colleague and a good friend. He will now remain a superdelegate. Senator Clinton will lose one delegate as a result of that unless the New York State Party selects another superdelegate shortly to replace him. I don't see it will change any the math as it currently exists.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, David Patterson was on stage with Hillary Clinton after the Iowa caucuses when she gave her concession speech, and he was right there. He's right there next to her. He's a Hillary Clinton supporter, but as Donna said, he is. You lose one because they will not. You lose one as Elliot Spitzer's vote kind of falls by the wayside right now.
And what do we know, Robert, about Patterson and his governance style, how well he gets along with people in his party and the other party? I mean, if you had to give me like a sales pitch, David Patterson is blank, what would it be?
Well, David Patterson is connected. He is sort of the second generation of a family. They're sort of humorously called the Harlem Mafia here in New York. That was the first generation of black politicians that came out of Harlem in the late 60s and early 70s. And that included a gentleman named Percy Sutton, who was the first black Manhattan borough president, David Dinkins, obviously the first black mayor of New York City, and David Patterson's father, Basil Patterson, who was the first black Secretary of State, and so Patterson is well connected. He's been a member of the legislature where he was first elected to the state senate in 1985, and he became lieutenant governor when Elliot Spitzer was elected in 2006.
He's becoming the first black governor and of New York, and yeah. America's first blind governor.
That's right.
Ever?
That's right. Because I think it was a certain kind of an infection that he got that about 2-3 months after he was born, and he is legally blind. I mean, he is known. He gets along well with everybody. I mean, there are concerns, and I say this. I mean, I'm on the Post editorial page, and we've critiqued David Patterson a few times. On some of his stands, and so, I mean, going in now, we're trying to be obviously in the context of what is good for New York. We are trying to, look for the best in this as the state moves forward. There is, though, a concern that Patterson coming in at a very, very sensitive time, because by state law, though this often gets waived, by state law, the new budget is supposed to be done by April 1st. I mean,
it's like yesterday.
Yeah, that's been missed numerous times. However, that's a very sensitive time for him to be coming in, and there's this concern that may end up being squeezed by the majority leader, Mr. Joe Bruno, and the assembly leader, Shelley Silver.
Now let me jump in because we don't have too much time left, and I want to get a quick update before we let you guys go on Florida and Michigan, the whole issue of revoting. Donna, what's happening there?
I just want to add, David Patterson is a hardworking, intelligent, very friendly politician. I think New Yorkers will be proud to have David Patterson as their governor. New York is in good shape, but of course, Michigan and Florida officials are now considering a revote. Under the rules, the same rules that penalized these two states for violating the rules of going ahead of schedule, will now allow them to come back and conduct a revote if it's in compliance with the rules. Now, they must conduct this revote. I don't know if it's vote by mail, vote in person, etc., but they must conduct it before June 10th because the primary season ends on June 10th. If they come up with a plan that is in compliance with the rules, and there are so many cumbersome rules as we put together to elect our president, then they will be approved and there will be a revote. Now, Senator Obama floated an idea, well, why not just, you know, take the votes as is, but split the delegates 50-50. Senator Clinton people have said no to that. But look, in order for this to move forward, both the Florida and Michigan officials must agree, as well as the Clinton and Obama campaign, and of course, members of the Democratic National Committee.
Now, Robert, when you think about the revote, the way that things played out, Barack Obama did not gain anything. He's sure to gain something from this. So is it already a de facto win for Obama if they even step into the ballot booth?
I would have to think so. I mean, it seems to me that if the Clinton campaign were smart, they would say, take Florida and take Michigan, and you know, do 50-50 on, and kind of do 50-50 on both of them, because I think arguably, if they do a revote in Florida, I think Hillary Clinton would still probably win. The margin, though, is going to be a lot less, and I think and Michigan, frankly, I think could go either way. As a Republican, I'm obviously looking at this with a certain sense of bemusement. However, my sense is that the big problem here, and this is obviously something that the Democrats have to deal with a little bit further down the road, the big problem here is the delegate allocation process. And if they had more states like the Republicans do that are winner take all, I mean, I think you would have a much more clear cut leader amongst these two candidates right now. And instead, they're going to be fighting it out basically delegate by delegate to the convention.
Robert and Donna, we're out of time. I got to, you know, it's always so much good stuff right now. You can't.
We didn't
get
even
to
get
it.
To talk about Geraldine Ferraro.
All right, guys. I absolutely have to let you go. Donna Brazil, author, columnist, and political strategist, joined us from Washington, D.C. Robert George, associate editorial page editor for The New York Post. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. White actors in blackface and politicians embroiled in sex scandals with red faces. With us this week on our Bloggers Roundtable, we've got Brandon Whitney, who runs the blog Homeland Colors. He also writes about politics for the websites Black Men in America and My Voice DC. And Dwayne Brayboy writes the blog Black Informant. Welcome, guys.
How you doing?
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, we just heard from our political analyst about the big scandal. This one involves the once squeaky clean New York Governor Eliot Spitzer and his involvement allegedly with the prostitution ring. He resigned his position today. Now, in January, the Detroit mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, came under fire for having a long-term sexual relationship with one of his top aides. The Detroit Free Press then reported details of the text messages with his chief of staff. She resigned amid allegations that she and the mayor lied under oath about the affair. A new column from the Detroit News suggests these two cases share a similar kind of arrogance that empowered each of these politicians to take risks. So, Brandon, let me start with you. Do you see a parallel?
To a certain extent. I kind of take this personally because I grew up in Detroit. The difference I can see between the two guys is that Spitzer had the integrity to resign and Kwame did not. Detroit is in too bad shape. It has a huge infant mortality rate. The schools are in bad shape for Kwame to stay in power and not do anything to really improve the situation of the city. He just needs to step down. He's a terrible influence, and he hasn't done anything that Archer didn't do, which was the mayor before him, that is worth talking about. So he needs to just go.
Well, Brandon, you know, this article argued that Spitzer's resignation would essentially force Kilpatrick's hand. Do you think that's going to happen?
I don't think so. I find black leaders in America tend to be very similar to leaders in some African countries in that they hold on to power until somebody boots them out. So basically what probably needs to take place is Kwame's going to have to get booted out somewhere somehow.
Dwayne, is it time for a coup?
Yeah, I pretty much second what he said. I mean, it's Mayor Kwame, he's not going anywhere. And it's unfortunate that here you have Spitzer. I mean, the moment this stuff broke out, here you had like a few days later. Now he's already out of the door, whereas Mayor Fitzpatrick, he's still, you know, he's still hanging around and want to do
Kill
a
Patrick.
Custer's last stand at the expense of the poor citizens of Detroit. So unfortunate.
And what's really sad about it is that a lot of people were excited when he first came into office. And I think the reason for that is that he was a younger guy and it seemed like he was going to bring a change. But when you compare him to a Cory Booker or you compare him to a Donna Edwards or a Barack Obama, he's falling very much short.
Yeah.
I want to bring in Carmen Van Kerkhove. She's joining us now, co-founder and president of New Demographic Anti-Racism Training Company. She also blogs at Racialicious. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
So I want to ask you about Elliot Spitzer's wife and the look on her face. I mean, it's there's so much discussion of the stand by your man mentality. And we have a woman running for president right now who pulled a stand by your man. What price do you think that takes out of people who are caught on the other end of these sex scandals?
And by other people, you mean the wives?
Yeah, the significant others, I mean, who are almost always wives, let's face it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really unfortunate because it really, you know, from what I've heard, Elliot Spitzer's wife is a very accomplished woman in her own right. And in a situation like this, she's really just reduced to this silent partner just standing by, you know, with a sorrowful look on her face. When really you have to wonder, you know, what if she were in office, what kinds of things could she be accomplishing rather than just simply being a spouse?
Now, Brandon, some people have even argued that Senator Clinton's favorables and her electability could go up if she, for whatever reason, broke up with Bill Clinton. That is complete speculation, but I throw it out there in the sense that how are women perceived when they stand by a man who has done them wrong, a politician who's done them wrong?
I can't really say. I think it really depends on a person's point of view. I think some people who come from a more feminist point of view might think that she's being used as a tool to support her husband or something of that nature. But my point of view is just, you know, I'm not married to the person. I can't judge them. You know, whatever they want to do in their personal relationship is up to them. I'm more concerned with how it affects government, and how it affects people's lives as opposed to their relationship.
Dwayne, I want to move us on to another topic. Hollywood and the issue of cross-racial casting. There's a new Ben Stiller comedy called Tropic Thunder. Robert Downey Jr. plays a white actor who dons blackface to play a role that was originally written for a black man. Now, last year, Angelina Jolie darkened her skin to play the role of Marianne Pearl, biracial woman, French woman, in the film A Mighty Heart. Have you seen those pictures of Downey?
Yes, I have. Yes.
What do you think about how they what they achieved with the makeup, and then the larger issue of is this fair game in evolving America?
Right. Well, for starters, I'm a huge Ben Stiller fan, so I know I'm going to be biased here. He's, you know, I think he can pull it off. For starters, the makeup, when I saw it, just that one slide that I saw, I thought they came a long way from the days of Soul Man or Soul Brother, wherever that movie was back in the
Soul
80s.
Man.
Yeah. I think this is – Hollywood does this stuff all the time. I mean, for example, I could think of two roles where Denzel Washington played – he played a role – I mean, he didn't don white makeup, but he played a role that was originally intended for white actors, and that was in Pelican Brief. And in the other movie, Much Ado About Nothing, where he played a I think he was like a Spanish prince or something like that. Yeah. And I think this is – like you kind of alluded to, I think this is just part of America finally evolving, where we feel confident and comfortable enough to do these kind of things and pull it off without having to do a protest every time someone does it. I mean, we all have a sense. I think to some degree, we all have a sense of humor, and I think it's quite okay to do it. I don't necessarily see a problem with it.
Carmen, there's another spin on this, which is not when white actors are playing people of color in makeup in a comedy, but also the question of what happens when there are fictionalized events based on a true story and they change the race of the people. There's another movie, 21, based on the book Bringing Down the House, about these MIT students who gamed Vegas casinos with their math skills. And the real MIT students were Asian, but they're white characters in the movie. Does that bother you at all?
It definitely bothers me. And as one blogger at Ultra Brown put it, finally you've got a movie about MIT math and gambling and they don't cast any Asians in it. I mean, it's really kind of ridiculous. One of the excuses that you often hear from Hollywood executives or producers is that there aren't enough good stories to be told that feature people of color. And so I think it's very significant when you've got a story like this, which turned into a best-selling book, which then is turning into a movie, is significant enough of a story to turn into a movie, and then yet they choose to turn all the almost all of the characters into white people. You know, I think that that's really something that we need to be questioning as to why is that really necessary. I mean, if you look at the success of a movie like Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, granted that's in a different genre, sort of a stoner comedy, but I think the success of that movie shows that the mainstream, so-called mainstream audiences don't need to only see white actors on the screen to be able to relate to them.
There was another case similar to this in the movie about 9/11, the Oliver Stone movie. You had a black Marine who ended up on screen as a white character, and there was a huge amount of outcry in some quarters of the black community just saying, well, hey, this guy's a hero and he's from our community. Why can't you show him that way? Brandon, do you think that was griping or do you think that was a fair critique?
I think it's a fair critique, but I think the real problem is that there's a lag between corporations, and that's basically who runs Hollywood and a lot of other places, and the public. I think they're still holding on to this old paradigm where they think that if it's not a white main character, you can't sell it to white audiences. And I think the American people are a lot more sophisticated than that. Back on the whole thing with the blackface, I watched Soul Man yesterday just to kind of prepare for this. And the thing is, it depends on how they do it. My biggest fear is that some folks that get so excited about the fact that he's in blackface to a certain extent, that they'll put all their energy into something like Robert Downey being in blackface, and it might not even be anything that's severely negative, more important problems.
Let me just describe Soul Man for folks who haven't seen the movie. It's this movie from 86 with C. Thomas Howell as this guy who poses as black to get a scholarship to Harvard. Now, it was really controversial at the time. What did you think when you saw it again?
I thought it was a brilliant piece of satire. It was about a white guy who didn't realize he had white privilege, who dressed up as a black person and found out he did have white privilege and what life was like. And it was funny and it was smart. And for all I know, that might be what this new movie with Ben Stiller will be. But I'm very afraid that we'll start getting IMUS-like protests and they'll start focusing on this issue instead of stuff like the murder rate in Philadelphia or the unemployment rate in Baltimore. We get so caught up in these symbolic issues that don't make a difference to anybody.
Well,
but
if
the makeup was awful.
The makeup was pretty jacked. So if you're just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are in the middle of our bloggers roundtable. And with me, we have Carmen Van Kerkhove. She's the co-founder and president of New Demographic and blogs at racialicious.com. Brandon Whitney runs the blog Homeland Colors. And Dwayne Brayboy writes the blog Black Informant. Now, I actually want to move on to, we don't usually do this, but we have gotten endorsement from you, Brandon. I wrote a post on our blog, News and Views, talking about ethnic pride among black folks, whether that pride can be divisive. And I wrote the post after a speech I gave in Iowa. I gave this speech and I had dinner with some black students, and a Haitian American freshman said that Haitians were better than black Americans because they'd kicked the French out of their homeland. And then I asked her friend, a black American woman, how she felt about her friend's comment, her Haitian friend's comment. And the second student said she was hurt in some ways, but she understood. And she said, "Our pride gets in the way. Black people are proud people and Haitians are proud people and we should be proud of each other. But sometimes our pride gets in the way." So this year, particularly with Barack Obama having, direct African ancestry through his father, and people talking about, is he a black American or an African American or language? And you have Jamaican Americans, Nigerian Americans, Haitian Americans. Do you think, Brandon, that there is a sea change in how we're viewing blackness and ethnicity? And why did the conversation resonate with you? Because you actually posted a reply to what I had written.
Yeah, it kind of resonated with me. Mostly, I'm dating a Kenyan, and so I got a chance to really find out more about the ethnic differences among black people. And what I've learned, and I used to drink Tuskers in college with a bunch of Kenyans as well, and what I'm learning is that the root of the problem of not being able to get along comes from two different things. One, it's a mutual ignorance of one another. African Americans and Americans in general know nothing about Africa because all you see is stuff on the news and the Discovery Channel. And Africans and people in the diaspora All they see of African Americans is what they see on television, and we're mutually ignorant of one another. And in the United States, and the other part of it is just low self-esteem. Like, arrogance is a sign of low self-esteem. And blacks, no matter where you are, if you're probably on the lower end of the totem pole in terms of class or status. And so to make up for that, we're often prideful and arrogant about our specific type of black person. And I think that's probably what the root of the problem is overall.
How does your girlfriend see it from her side? Does she perceive black Americans as arrogant?
No, she doesn't, actually. She grew up in both Kenya and America, and so she's been back and forth. So she can actually see it from both sides. We rarely bump heads on it. We're different culturally in a lot of ways, in terms of the way we view things. But luckily, we're both kind of open-minded. I've interacted with Africans, and they are the best folks to party with. and I enjoy the company, but I've also run into some cases where people make statements like, "Yeah, you're pretty smart for an African American," and a lot of that is really just ignorance about each other, and it's not all their fault or our fault, because we're seeing the images we see are always negative, and to be honest with you, America's never really bothered to really recognize the fact that African Americans, the descendants and cultural descendants of the slaves, have a unique culture. We're not just a race.
Let me throw you in here, Carmen. I mean, there's often a lot of attention to interracial issues, but this is an intraracial, interethnic issue. I mean, you know, and you know, if you go into Asian culture, you'll see divisions between Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, etc. If you go into any race, you know, the Irish and the English, you know, do we really talk about that in the U.S.? Should we be talking about it?
I think we're starting to see a little bit more conversation about that, and I really agree with Brandon about the fact that it's really a matter of mutual ignorance, because I think you see the same kinds of attitudes in terms of, well, because a lot of the, immigrants from Africa tend to be immigrants that have been in the country not too long. And you see the same kinds of attitudes among, I think, Asian immigrants and also Hispanic immigrants, where there's the sense of, well, look at us. We're pulling ourselves up by the bootstraps. We're getting it done. Why can't you get it done? And that really comes from a lack of understanding of the history of this country and really the role that institutional racism plays and white supremacy still continues to play. And so I think that is another area in which more conversations and more mutual understanding needs to happen.
Dwayne, when you think about your friendships, do you have any instances where you get to talk about these issues with people you know who are black but of other ethnicities?
You know, the friends that I did have, you know, when I was living in Atlanta some years back that were African descent or Jamaican or what have you, I mean, we were just friends. I mean, it was something that never really came up. It was really not a big issue, you know, not at all. So that's my experience, but I can only speak for myself.
And I guess in the end, when you think about this, Brandon, what do you ever try to proselytize to your black American friends, or have your girlfriend reach out to her Kenyan friends and try to say, look, just give people, you know, other black people who are different a chance? Is it ever the kind of thing where you have to step into a like leadership / peacemaker role?
I don't think it's ever really gotten to that point. I think the best thing that you can do, if you're a person who's a little bit more aware about the two different cultures, is just ask questions. When people make statements, just how do you know is a great question to ask somebody. And to really, you know, the biggest thing is it's very difficult for us to learn about each other's culture. So you have to, I think, encourage people to find out more. I mean, if you're trying to find out about Africa, I've done it. Tried to do it online. It's pretty difficult to find something that's about contemporary Africa unless you're straight going up to the newspapers. And if you're trying to find out more about, the black middle class or black people, the African American middle class and people who are doing well, it can be difficult. So it's just a matter of, I think we need to really get the word out on both sides of the divide and just explain each other to each other.
All right.
Go ahead.
Well, unfortunately, we got to wrap up. Great discussion. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Brandon Whitney of the blog Homeland Colors. He was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Carmen Van Kerkhove, co-founder of New Demographic. She blogs at Racialicious, and she was at our New York studios. And Dwayne Brayboy of the blog Black Informant. He was at member station KUCI in Irvine, California. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. So you're heading to college. Your grades say Ivy League, but your income says community college. In the past, you might not have been able to raise the funds to attend your dream school. Now, if you make the grade, you might not have to worry as much about your finances. Elite schools like Harvard, Yale, and Stanford are offering free tuition to students from lower-income families. But what impact will these initiatives have on access and diversity in higher education? In a moment, we'll put that question to Jeff Salingo. He's the editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. But first, we've got Anthony Berryhill. When he was an undergrad at Stanford University, his financial aid package offered him grants and loans, but that money didn't stretch quite as far as he thought it would. Anthony, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
So you are a grad student now at Yale. You have basically just been churning through the best schools in America. And, you know, but let's back it up a little bit. You are sure. From New Orleans, from the lower Ninth Ward, and you had great grades. You got into Stanford. Were you concerned once you got accepted that you wouldn't get a good financial aid package?
I was initially concerned. And then when I saw the financial aid package, it seemed like a very, well, not just seemed like, it was a very, very good offer. There were relatively few loans. I only had about $7,000 worth over 4 years. So it was a good deal. The acceptance and the financial aid package came very close to each other. So I wasn't that concerned about the finances, at least before I went to Stanford.
Now, you say before you went to Stanford, because even though you got a good package, there were still some tight times. What exactly did you have to deal with?
Absolutely. I think what I had to deal with were a lot of the hidden costs, the costs that, although they are written into a financial aid package, for example, there are allowances for books and travel, et cetera, a lot of the very basic things that most would take for granted were covered. For example, to buy a plane ticket from New Orleans to California is not a cheap proposition, but at least about $300, $350. So if you're from a very lower income environment, that can be quite crushing. That's one. Another one was just even day-to-day expenses, for example, paying for books, which books at a college bookstore can cost as much as $100 or even $130, and even more so for course packs. And when I went to Stanford, we didn't have online used book sales services, so it took a lot of ingenuity in order to figure out how to make ends meet.
So do you think that colleges really need to factor in these, I wouldn't call them exactly hidden costs, but these secondary costs when they really think about what students have to go through?
I think what's been done recently is it's a huge deal in terms of getting rid of loans and making tuition affordable. In terms of a lot of the secondary costs, I think so. At the very least, I think there should be some kind of dialogue from a financial aid office to talk about a lot of these factors. Because when I was going to a financial aid office saying, I have these huge costs, there are these things that are expected out of me in order if I want to even do research. A lot of the rhetoric I got back was just assuming that I would already have the resources or take enough jobs to pay for such things. So I think a good second step post the tuition breaks would be at least having some infrastructure for dealing with those kinds of extra costs that aren't very obvious if you're filling out a FAFSA form or looking at a financial aid package.
All right. Well, I want you to stay with us, and I want to bring in Jeff Salingo. He's editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education, and that publication has been looking at some of these financial aid programs from elite universities. How are you doing, Jeff?
I'm pretty good today.
So give us an update on how things have been unfolding with these elite universities really rolling out the red carpet to students not just from low-income families but from middle-income and even upper-middle-income families.
Well, basically, in December, Harvard announced that they were going to ask families with salaries between $120,000 and $180,000 a year to pay no more than 10% of their income. They were also going to eliminate loans for low-income students as well, something that they started doing a couple of years ago. What has happened since then is that basically all of their competitors and other elite wealthy institutions have followed along with similar financial aid programs. We see this every couple of years where Harvard comes out with a new financial aid policy, and then all of its competitors and other institutions follow along. So we now have about a dozen to two dozen institutions out there really offering very good deals to middle-income parents.
Does this mean in a weird way that if you're able to get into a school like Harvard, like Columbia, that you might get a better deal from them than you would from other schools?
Oh, definitely. And especially, I think, the group that's feeling the heat right now are public universities. Because essentially what this does is put the price of these elite private colleges down to the price of a public university. When you talk about, you know, 10% of their income for middle-income families, that really puts the price of Harvard down to the price of UNC Chapel Hill or the University of Virginia or University of Michigan, all very good public colleges, but public colleges that are now really competing also on price with the Harvards of the world.
And Jeff, do you think this is going to shake up who goes where? I mean, is this going to mean that more lower-income students end up at Harvard, or is it just going to provide a better situation for people who would have gone there anyway?
I think it's going to be much more of the latter. I think that basically students who would have gone to Harvard and had to pay a lot of money to go there are now going to basically still be able to go there, and they're just going to have to pay a lot less. And in fact, we might even see more competition to try to get into Harvard now because the price is going to be so much lower than it used to be.
Anthony, when you think about K through 12 education, it's one you know, in order to get into one of these top tier schools, you have to be very on your game academically, but also part of whether or not you succeed in being qualified has to do with how good your local school systems are. Does this put pressure on local school systems or the whole question of educational access? Does it all just end up trickling back down to the K through 12? And how does that impact black students, students of color, students from lower income families?
I'm not sure how much the tuition breaks would pose burdens on the local schools. I mean, for example, pre-Katrina New Orleans, I mean, there were lots of issues in terms of the quality of public school system, et cetera. And what I do think, though, is that if the goal of the tuition breaks is to get more lower-income black students, or even lower-income students, period, a lot of the interventions that would have to happen would have to go beyond a financial aid policy. For example, I mean, I went to because of an outreach program, I was able to go to a very good private school in New Orleans. But a lot of people in my neighborhood who didn't go to such a school, they didn't have college counselors, or they didn't have even the familial networks to tell them, here's when you should study for the SAT, or even here's when you should apply for a FAFSA, and here's how you do so. So I think the pressure would come for more in terms of helping people who are lower income make up the gap in terms of understanding how to apply for college, what does it really entail, and filling in some of those networks for them, which at this point, I really don't see happening yet.
Jeff, finally, when you look at the initiatives that are going on the higher education level, are there any initiatives that are as bold on issues of diversity as they are on these financial aid issues?
No, not really. I mean, what colleges talk a lot about diversity, and many colleges are doing very well on that front. But most of these policies are aimed squarely at the middle class. And mainly that's in reaction to pressures from Congress on college costs. And again, when Congress talks about college costs, they're really talking about the college costs for middle-class families because that makes up their constituents. Those are the constituents they hear from most often. So most of the initiatives are really aimed squarely at the middle class and not necessarily at increasing diversity.
Well, Jeff, Anthony, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Salingo is editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education, and Anthony Berryhill is a graduate student at Yale University. We're the ship, all else is the sea. That's how baseball team owner Rube Foster described the Negro National League. Foster was a pitching legend when he helped form the circuit for pro-black teams. That was almost 90 years ago. The league gave black ball players a chance to shine in ways the majors never had. Sluggers became heroes, owners got rich, and everyone got a fair swing at doing what they loved, playing ball. The Negro National League's last innings came in the 1940s after Jackie Robinson headed for the big leagues. Kadir Nelson's new book, We Are the Ship, captures black American baseball at the top of its game. Kadir is an award-winning children's book illustrator. He's collaborated with Will Smith, Spike Lee, and Debbie Allen. For We Are the Ship, he did all of the writing and all of the artwork, and his rich, detailed paintings show Negro League superstars as if they're posing for the camera or deep in a game of hardball. Kadir Nelson joins me now. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So you have done playful children's books. You've illustrated books for young people about historic figures. Tell me about Buck O'Neill.
Buck O'Neill was a former player and manager and for the Kansas City Monarchs and the Negro Leagues. And he became the first African-American coach in the major leagues. And I was introduced to Buck O'Neill through the PBS Ken Burns documentary, Baseball, which was airing in the mid-90s. And at that point, I was commissioned to do a painting on the Negro Leagues, and I really didn't know much about it. So I, in doing my research, I came across the documentary, and I was so inspired by Buck's retelling of his days in the Negro Leagues that I became inspired to create not only that painting I was commissioned to paint, but it grew into over 6 paintings and then finally over to over 40 paintings and the creation of this book.
Now, this is the first book that you've written and done the artwork for. How is that different than working with someone else?
Well, everything was coming from me, so it was a bit more relaxed. The process was very organic because, I didn't intend to write a book or to create these paintings for a book. I was just doing this out of the love for the subject. But, the more and more I became familiar with this story that, I figured that I really wanted to tell this story in a book and share this story with others because it was so inspirational. It's a great story of perseverance and innovation and pride and excellence amidst adversity. When African Americans were confronted with a ban from playing Major League Baseball at the end of the 19th century, they loved baseball so much that they wanted to form their own league. They wanted to form their own grand stage, which would allow them to play baseball for a living. And that grand stage became the Negro Leagues, one of the most profitable and successful African-American-owned businesses of all time.
Now, you had a unique way of preparing for the book, especially the way you got ready to do the paintings. Tell me how you used the uniform as a way to psych yourself up.
Well, what I wanted to do was to shed new light on this subject and show share this history in a very new way. That I wanted to show new images from the Negro Leagues that had never been seen before. And the only way I could do that really was through this medium, the painted medium. So when I was getting ready to write the manuscript and paint these paintings, I literally put myself in the shoes of a former Negro League player. I bought an old uniform or a replica uniform. I borrowed some pants from the Negro League Baseball Museum and put on some long tube socks and old dress shoes and posed as each of the players and took a picture of myself as each of the players to show these new angles, new light on the subject. And I also read a number of books on the Negro Leagues, and I interviewed a number of former players, Buck O'Neill being one of them.
What was that like for you?
It was a great thrill. Meeting Buck O'Neill is kind of like meeting someone like Michael Jordan when he's in his 80s. He still had that swagger. He was such a charming man. I remember one day I was at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, and I was sitting in the office waiting to meet with the marketing director, Bob Kendrick, and Buck O'Neill just walked past the door, and he saw me sitting there. And he looked at me and said, "Hey, young man." And, it just made my day because Buck was that kind of a person. He was so giving. He was a great ambassador to baseball. And it's great to see that they're finally inducting Buck into the Hall of Fame this year.
Let's talk a little bit about one of the specific pieces that you have. On pages 6 and 7, you have a very rich painting of Rube Foster and some of his players stepping off a train. They're in suits and ties. They've got nice luggage. They're wearing nice caps, looking dignified and strong. Mm-hmm. And Rube's at the center with a cane and a cigar. A couple of little boys are looking on. You can't help but respect these men. Now, this book is about baseball, but there's also this tradition of sports being a heroic space in American society. Is that what you were trying to get at? And what did you want to achieve with images like that?
Well, I look at this book as more than just a baseball book. It's a portrait of a great era, of a great group of talented players and owners who wouldn't compromise on their dreams. And I wanted to show what it was like for a Negro League baseball player on and off the field. So when you look at images like group of players getting off of the Pullman car, or there's an image of the players on their way to a game in the bus singing. It's kind of like a quintet. These are images that really give a great glimpse into what it was like for those players. When you look at the artwork, whenever I take on a portrait, a painting of an individual, I want to paint more than just their likeness. I want to paint their spirit. And when you look at images in this book, it's like, you know, there's background music, and that background music is, it's the determination of these players, the perseverance, the excellence, this spirit of not wanting to give in to the attitudes, the racial attitudes of the day. So when you look at the image of this group, as was described in one of the descriptions of one of the players, they described this group of big Negroes departing from this train, and it was such a great image. I wanted to actually show that in this book. They describe what it was like to play in the Latin Americas. They said it was the weather was hot, but the fans were even hotter. what it was like to when they're singing on the bus going to different games. You know, they played baseball every day. Baseball was an everyday thing, but they loved this game so much. You know, they weren't able to sleep where they weren't able to stay where they played, because you know, they couldn't stay in a white-owned hotel. So sometimes they'd have to sleep on the bus.
But they were men who persevered. Kadir, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Kadir Nelson wrote and illustrated the new book, We Are the Ship, The Story of Negro League Baseball, and he joined me from the studios of KPBS in San Diego.